Now the interview with human rights activist David Oakes.
Today we are speaking with David Oakes of Mind Freedom International. David, could you tell us what your organization does and how long have you been at this?
I've been doing this work for 30 years, ever since I personally experienced the mental health system as a college student. And Mind Freedom has been active since 1987. We've won a lot of campaigns. We're based here in Eugene, and now we unite 100 sponsor groups internationally. We're the only group of our kind in the UN. Most of our members have personally experienced human rights abuse in the mental health system. And we're a totally independent group that speaks out and for human rights and for alternatives in the mental health system.
And what do you consider human rights issues?
Well, I was personally forcibly drugged in the psychiatric system, held down and injected. And now that's happening more and more on an outpatient basis using court orders. There's certainly people being tied down, solitary confinement, labeling. And then there's more subtle things like the way the mental health system tends to lead to discrimination. The psychiatric labels can lead to poverty and stereotypes. And more we're facing human rights violations because of the power of the psychiatric drug industry. Our members are pro-choice. You know, if we respect their decisions about taking psychiatric drugs, and many of them do. But the drug companies are getting to be so powerful that they are causing human rights violations because of the way they have taken over the mental health system, the way they promote forced drugging, for instance, the way they lie about hazards from the psychiatric drugs, and the way they squeeze out non-drug alternatives from mental health care.
They basically say that their way is the way, the best way, and so the alternatives, what would they be?
Well, nowadays, if you go to a mental health conference, if you read a mental health journal, if you pick up some research about the mental health system, a lot of times that research and conferences, those events are actually funded directly or indirectly by the mental health system. So you often don't hear that, say, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill gets a big portion of their funding from the psychiatric drug industry. So alternatives tend not to be discussed as much. Examples would include supported housing, supported employment, where people can get job training and housing with help. Also, alternatives such as peer support. And even quality counseling is not very readily available. A lot of our members have found all kinds of alternatives by their own choice. We find that it's not one alternative is the answer. It's people's empowerment and self-determination help them get on their own two feet. So alternatives such as acupuncture, nutrition, massage, using nature, creativity. The myth has been put out, and now so more and more people are being put on the drugs. And now we're seeing mental health screening, where they're going into the schools all over the country with these tests that seem pretty harmless. They give the kids a quiz. Do you feel sad? Do you feel upset? Do you feel like hurting yourself? And in a way, this can seem really common sense. You know, let's look for kids that are in trouble.
What age?
It tends to be about 9 years and up, but they can go even younger. They can go to younger children any age and do the screening. But it tends to be early adolescence and through especially high schools are being targeted. It's similar to the way the military is, getting into the schools to get kids to join the Army. It's the same way the mental health system is getting in there, and it's harvesting customers. It's kind of a dragnet. Again, it may sound like a good idea, let's look for troubled kids, but looking for troubled kids is a lot better when it's done with people, where there's people who get, adults who get to know young people, spend time with them, and really find out what's going on with them. These tests are used to then refer the family to mental health care, and that can mean the drug approach. So there's what's been called by a federal bureaucrat a curious coalition that includes both right-wing and left-wing. Both red and blue states are have people speaking out against mental health screening, and it's kind of cool to see organizing going on beyond political labels.
Does your organization have a mailing list? How do you get your information out to the general public?
We have a human rights alert list that goes out to 13,000 people who then tend to copy that and post it other places. And anybody is welcome to get on that. Any of your listeners, it's a free public service. They can find out about it on our website, mindfreedom.org. But what's going on, this campaign is successful because now they're even covering up what schools are getting introduced to screening. Because when a school is announced, often in the grassroots, opposition gets raised with the local media, with the school board. We have had some changes. They're now doing a better informed consent sheet, and also the top federal bureaucrat on health care, his name is Charlie Curry. He's in charge of the mental health system for the federal government. It's called SAMHSA, Substance Mental Health System Administration. Curry has announced publicly that the federal government is backing down on pushing universal mental health screening. Now, that's their words, though, so that's a good victory, but the reality is that screening is marching forward. So your child or you may be screened. They're now training general practitioners, your family doctor, to ask additional mental health questions. And if you answer the wrong way, then you can be immediately prescribed a psychiatric drug by these kind of cookie-cutter approaches that they're teaching to the doctors. So it's all a way to get more and more Americans onto psychiatric drugs, as if not enough were on them already.
So what would the wrong way be? And what if you didn't take the drugs? And does that go on your record in some way? Does that follow you somehow?
Well, for schools, if you answer a quiz and say that, say you're upset that day, say that you had a bad day and you put down that you're upset, that doesn't automatically get you a label. It kind of puts you on a conveyor belt, and so then you're recommended to go to a mental health specialist for an exam. The problem with going in front of a mental health specialist is that they tend to have one tool in their toolbox. A hammer, and they kind of hammer everything they see with a psych label. So you are at risk of getting a psych label. Once you have a psych label, that can follow you for life. And also, it can often mean psychiatric drugs. And 9 times out of 10, in one study, labels for young people meant that psych drugs were introduced. So you're putting a child at risk of being drugged and labeled. Now, if you refuse, if the family refuses, there have been instances where this can cause trouble for the family, especially, for instance, in a divorce. One parent can argue that the other parent is negligent. And there have been some cases where kids have been put into foster care because they claim that parents were being medically negligent by not drugging the child. Now, this arouses such incredible rage by the general public when they find out about this, that these instances don't happen that much where they point-blank force a family to drug a child. If you refuse, you'll probably get away with it. What they're after is kind of a dragnet where you can get literally tens of thousands or even, by one estimate, more than 100,000 more young people on the psych drugs by just having these blanket tests and then putting them on the conveyor belt to labeling and drugging. So we're looking at a program that could mean a massive increase of psychiatric drugging of young people. And like I said, they're also teaching general practitioners. So next time you're in there for a cold, your doctor may be asking you some special questions about depression.
It's one-stop shopping.
Yeah, you could end up on psych drugs. And also, this is mainly in the U.S., mm-hmm. but internationally, the drug companies are targeting Africa, Asia, South America. They want to saturate the rest of the world with psych drugs, just the way they've saturated the U.S. with psych drugs.
Now, what about Europe and maybe Japan? Are they allowed to go in and have the sort of ad campaigns that they have in the United States?
Informational ads are starting in Ireland where they are just kind of feel-good ads about the drug company itself. But no, the U.S. And to a limited extent Canada are some of the few places where they allow direct to consumer advertising of psych drugs. There may be some other, a few other countries I don't know about, but in developed countries, it tends to be the U.S. Of course, Japan has a huge rate of commitment where people are committed very frequently. It's very conformist, tends to be, and also Europe. Even progressive so-called countries in Europe are using a lot of psych drugs, electroshock. It's really a global problem, and the World Health Organization at our prodding has said that there's a global emergency of human rights violations in the mental health system. And, in fact, they dedicated International Human Rights Day to human rights of people in the mental health system.
Well, how is it that we've reached the point that we've become so inundated and indoctrinated with the benefits of these drugs without being told of the negative effects of them?
Well, you know, there's that famous saying by Pastor Niemöller that a lot of progressive folks know. During Nazi Germany, first they came for the communists, and I was not a communist, so I didn't do anything. Well, in the mental health system, first they came for people in the state hospitals. They locked them up in the back wards. They gave them the force shock. They locked them up, and they gave them the drugs and the and so forth. And the general public didn't do anything. The general public said, oh, well, I'm not a mental patient. I'm not going to worry about that much. Well, now the psychiatric industry is coming for the general public. And actually, usually when I talk to people about mental health and human rights, they quietly disclose that they have an aunt, an uncle, a brother, a sister, or themselves have personally experienced the mental health system and often had trouble or difficulties with the system. So this hurts a lot of people, but people don't talk about these issues that much. But yeah, the general public has been convinced that that these drugs are wonder drugs. An example is the Thorazine-type drugs, which are called neuroleptics. There's some newer varieties of neuroleptics like clozapine, Risperdal, Zyprexa, olanzapine. So these are newer neuroleptics. And we've been told, oh, these are wonder drugs, and they're much better than the older neuroleptics. And therefore, the taxpayers should pay for these drugs, and they often cost several hundred dollars a month. They've been named as one of the main budget busters for getting health, state health care for poor people. That's what tends to break the budget when you try to provide funding for health care for low-income people, are these extremely expensive, they're called atypical neuroleptics. Well, there's a new big, huge study out that shows that almost all the newer drugs perform the same as the older drug, that there turns out to be not that big of a difference between the newer drugs and the older drugs. So the taxpayers have been kind of giving a blank check to the mental health system. What I like to tell progressives is that for years the progressive position has been kind of simple about mental health. It's just been more money. Yeah, the mental health system needs more money. What's the next issue? And instead, progressives need and the public needs to get hands-on with the mental health system in terms of a democracy, getting hands-on, get informed about what these drugs do, what the alternatives are, what their rights are.
How does the stigma of a mental illness as compared to a physical illness, for example, cancer, affect a person's or a society's willingness to actually become informed and empowered?
Certainly the medical system has problems of disempowerment almost everywhere you look. The medical industry is over-drugging, is covering up problems, is corrupt. It's just the whole medical establishment has failed this country and its customers. That said, the mental health piece is kind of amplified because you're dealing with some of the most vulnerable, marginalized people in a society. People with a psychiatric label are among the most marginalized. They tend to keep quiet about the label. So, for instance, electroshock tends to be elder women get electroshock, some of the most vulnerable people in our society. So the mental health piece, which goes after our minds, our thoughts, our behavior, that kind of, and it can often be done forcibly. Like I say, here in Oregon, you can be court-ordered to take the drugs while living at home, out in the community, peacefully, you can be court-ordered to take these drugs. So this means that the psychiatric industry is kind of one of the worst pieces of a broken medical system.
So does that mean if you don't take the drugs that you could actually land in jail?
What they do is, an example is they'll tell you, you're committed, but we'll let you out if you sign this piece of paper. Now, people will sign anything to get out of a horrible institution.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trial visit, it turns out. And if you violate any of the agreements on the trial visit, boom, you could end up locked up. You'll have a trial visit revocation hearing, and boom, you're locked up again in the psych facility. So, yeah, literally, for saying no to a psych drug, you can be locked up. So out here in the community, if you say yes to a recreational drug, you can be put in prison. If you say no to a psych drug, you can be locked up in a psych institution.
And is Oregon typical? And what kind of things are being done to stop this locally?
Oregon was one of the first states to adopt outpatient commitment, where you can just be court-ordered to follow medical orders on an outpatient basis in the psychiatric system. But the state tends to use those trial visit methods when they want to coerce you on an outpatient basis. Now, there's been some rays of hope here in the state. For instance, the Bob Nickel, who is now the director of the state mental health system, has made a lot of statements supportive of human rights, empowerment, and self-determination, and each month he meets with a mental health consumer survivor council that is providing him input. But the proof's in the pudding. The state of Oregon is one of the few states in the country that does not have an Office of Consumer Affairs, does not have any state employee whose title is to be a liaison to mental health consumers and customers, does not fund a statewide group to do conferences and so forth and alternatives. So Oregon is really, you know, what's happening is we're getting the words right, but we're not dancing the tune.
Why is that?
I'm finding this is happening throughout the system. It's an improvement over when I started 30 years ago. The mental health system, like at the World Health Organization, the federal level, here in Lane County, the head of the county mental health system, a lot of them are saying the right buzzwords now. They're talking about empowerment, self-determination, recovery, advocacy, human rights, transformation of the mental health system. But these tend to be just buzzwords until they're put into action. I think what's going on is that the culture of the mental health system is so harmful that it's going to take a nonviolent revolution to really change it. It's going to take the general population getting involved, getting outraged about the huge amount of taxpayer money going to the drug companies, the brain damage being caused by the psychiatric drugs, the addiction. People are going to start demanding that when they have a crisis, when a family member has a crisis, that they deserve more than just a bag of pills and a label.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting calls every day from distraught family members, moms and dads and brothers who say, you know, my relative is in a crisis. What can be done other than drugging them to the gills? People really want some kind of humane alternatives. Now, I found out that in Finland and Sweden, a young person diagnosed with schizophrenic has a chance to enter an alternative program that uses low-dose or no-dose approaches. That is, they will receive no psychiatric drugs or very, very low dosages of psychiatric drugs to see if they can get through their crisis without being drugged to the gills. And why isn't that available here in the U.S.?
Why?
Well, I think that if I were to sum it up, I'd say that real recovery, where we have real emotional and mental recovery, involves very deep change. It involves very deep social change.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk to people in distress, they often need very intangible things like love and support and contact and hope and community and empowerment, and they need things like jobs and housing. And you can't put these things in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
You can't buy and sell them. You can't buy and sell democracy, empowerment, social change, but you can buy and sell drugs. And so what we're seeing is that what gets labeled is anything that interrupts the kind of the machine, or as Ken, my buddy Ken Kesey called it, the combine. he called it the combine. Anything that interrupts the machine of the economic system is considered crazy, and then to treat it, they look for something that you can buy and sell, which is drugs and shock and so forth.
Something measurable.
Something tangible that you can buy and sell. In my workshops, I like to point out, you know, why is it that a bought hug does not feel the same as a spontaneous hug? If you mm-hmm. go to somebody and you pay them $10 to hug you, why does that feel different than a community member hugging you spontaneously? And it's because there's some things that can't be bought and sold. But we're so in the big picture, there's things like economic inequality that are leading to a lot of this disempowerment. In the mental health system, you have some of the richest people, most powerful people in our community tend to be white males, who are treating some of the poorest, most disempowered people who don't have much of a voice, and that can lead to a tremendous amount of abuse.
Which brings up the subject of peer support. Tell us kind of what it is and,
sure.
and consumer advocacy, and then the difference between what peer support would be and psychiatry or social work, or, you know, how those different how those various fields work with or against each other.
By peer support, we mean people helping each other. I mean, that's how people have always helped each other. The World Health Organization has done several large studies about who recovers best. And guess what? If you are diagnosed schizophrenic, your best chance of full recovery is to live in a poor developing country with the least psychiatrists. Your chance of recovery is double. What is it that developing countries tend to have better than what we have? They have community. They have family. They have tolerance for each other, and they look at each other's problems from other lenses other than just this kind of medical perspective that kind of segregates you into chemically and genetically different. Peer support is very, very complicated in if you look at it, because it involves a lot of different levels between close people, between equals. The mental health system tends to have this Western model that has been called scientific, but it's actually not very scientific, which tends to be very dominating. I call it the dominating model. So you have this individual who claims that they, a doctor, have insight into your problem, and it tends to be disempowering. You know, you have that stereotype of the MD or the medical deity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this very removed person who's trying to objectively study your behavior and give it a psychiatric label, and it turns out that closeness and equality are the best for recovery. So a lot of the mental health system's kind of helpless to help. But there are dissident mental health professionals who are speaking out. There are authors, speakers, psychiatrists, psychologists who are courageously bucking this trend. They don't want to be just mind control police dispensing drugs. They didn't get into this profession to do that. So they're speaking out about it. A number of them have books that you can see on our website.
Okay.
And so we work closely with mental health workers and mental health professionals to speak out.
David, thank you very much for joining us today. Would you please mention your website again?
Sure. People can call us toll-free at 1-877-MAD-PRIDE. Or check out our website at mindfreedom.org. Or you can just Google the word mind freedom, one word, mind freedom. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Okay.
That was David Oakes, the executive director of mindfreedom.org in Eugene, Oregon. I'm Marlise Franklin.
Good morning. It's a Thursday morning radio zine for Thursday, May 4th. The preceding program was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991. Or theportlandalliance.org. Stay tuned next. Teresa Mitchell is on vacation today, but stay tuned. Instead of Press Watch, we'll have a special election season program featuring the candidates for the Democratic side in the race for Oregon State Representative District 46. District 46 covers parts of northeast and southeast Portland, including the neighborhoods of Laurelhurst, Mount Tabor, South Tabor, Center, Montevilla, Woodland Park, and parts of Powellhurst, Gilbert, and Hazelwood. Wow, I didn't know that. Anyway, at 10:10, hear an interview with documentary filmmaker Fawn Keim. Her new film, The Tomato Effect, explores her father's death 10 years ago. He led a controversial life as a physician practicing environmental medicine. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard speaks with Portland painter and teacher Lucinda Parker about her current show at the Laura Russo Gallery and much more. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, go inside an immigration prison. We'll also hear an interview with the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, the only person charged in this country in connection to the 9/11 attacks. He was sentenced to life in jail without parole, a verdict which is a blow to the Bush administration, who were seeking the death penalty. And now, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher will be bringing you this candidate's forum for District 46. Stay tuned.